The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, I'm Carrie Klein, and I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who is going to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. So Dave, in our first story, we're looking at quantifying pain.
Right. Well, Carrie, if you've ever gone to the doctor's office in pain, sometimes they make you fill out that chart, that 1 to 10 of sort of frowny faces to smiley faces. How much pain are you in? Well, the problem with that is that's all really subjective, and doctors would love a way to, sort of like they take your temperature and they get a number, look at something in your brain, maybe a scan of your brain, and be able to tell actually quantitatively how much pain you're in. Nothing's really come close to that. Some fMRI studies, looks at activity in the brain, have shown that certain regions of the brain light up when people think about painful thoughts or social rejection. But that's not really the same as physical pain. And that's really what the researchers were trying to get at in this study.
Right. And so that could also determine, you know, kind of a yes or no about thinking or experiencing pain. But how do we actually quantify it?
Well, what the researchers did was they took about 100 or so healthy participants, and they induced some pain. They had what was basically a hot plate connected to the volunteers' arms, and they were cranking up the temperature. At first, they started with about 44 degrees Celsius, which is not too bad, and that went up to 49 degrees Celsius, which is kind of like a hot cup of coffee. So it started to get painful. And what the researchers noticed is they increased the temperature and therefore increased the pain. They were seeing various regions of the brain light up. And what was really important was these regions didn't really light up when people thought about social rejection, when they thought about maybe their ex-girlfriends or boyfriends. So this wasn't emotional pain. This was physical pain that the brain was responding to.
So were the researchers actually able to correlate the amount of pain to the parts of the brain that were lighting up?
Yeah, they found that the pain signature, as they call it, scaled with the increase in temperature. So the more pain the subjects were feeling, the stronger the pain signature. What they also found was that when they gave subjects a pain-relieving chemical, this pain signature went away. So again, it really suggested this was really tied to physical pain as opposed to other types of pain.
So what's a situation in which we might actually take advantage of this kind of technology?
Well, you know, for one thing, again, you know, doctors really wanted this non-subjective measurement of pain. Also could help them determine how much drugs to administer. And also for people that aren't verbal, doctors could still be able to determine how much pain they're in without actually having to talk to them. So there's really a lot of uses here. This is still kind of a small study, so the researchers clearly want to do some more work, but a really promising result for researchers that want to objectively quantify how much pain we're in.
And our next story is all about the relationship between sight and communication.
Well, Carrie, this story has to do with how much eye contact influences our development early in life. There's been some anecdotal evidence that if we don't have eye contact with our parents, especially our mothers, very early in life when we're babies, that we can develop a lot of social disorders. For example, children that are severely neglected in orphanages or children that are born blind are more likely to have traits of autism. They have a hard time forming social attachments. They tend to be more hyperactive. They even have cognitive impairment. And that's not a surprise because researchers have long thought that this loving gaze between mother and child helps build social skills that can last a lifetime. But these are pretty extreme examples. And for the new study, the researchers wanted to see, can we get a better sense of how much eye contact really matters in these early stages of life?
So how did they tackle that question?
Well, instead of looking at blind babies, they looked at blind mothers. They actually studied five babies that were born to mothers that couldn't see. They studied various aspects of the children's visual, motor, and language skills at various stages of development, from 6 to 10 months, 12 to 15 months, and 24 to 47 months. And what they found, which was really surprising, was that the children of blind mothers did just as well on all of these tests that the researchers gave them as the children that were born to mothers with normal vision.
Wow. So what does that say about the the way in which we learn and develop eye contact and eyesight.
Well, it suggests that this eye contact itself is not the ultimate determiner of our development of these social skills. Again, it's only 5 children. It's a small study, but it suggests that other things can be equally as important. A loving touch, caressing, talking to, things like that. Another really interesting thing about the study was not only did these children seem to do just as well as children born to sighted mothers, but in some cases they actually did better. A lot of them did better on verbal tests. They outscored their peers in visual tasks, such as remembering the location of a hidden toy or switching their attention from one toy to another. So that was really interesting. And the researchers think it could be analogous to children that are born to parents that speak 2 different languages. Mm-hmm. Studies have shown that children that grow up bilingual also have some advantages. And this is sort of bilingual, you know, learning how to deal with an adult that has sight and an adult that doesn't have sight causes these children to switch between various modes of communication early in development, and that could actually give them some advantages.
Well, very cool. And finally, our third story here presents some really interesting findings from dinosaur eggs.
Carrie, this story also has to do with early development, but this is even earlier in development than the example we were talking about in the previous story. This is embryonic development, and it's not humans, it's dinosaurs. This story has to do with a dinosaur called Lophangosaurus, which lived about 200 million years ago in the Yunnan province in southern China. What was really cool about these dinosaurs is they were the biggest creatures around at the time. This is during the Jurassic period. They were 9 meters long. And what researchers have long wondered is, how do these animals get so big?
Not having been present in the Jurassic period, how can we begin to answer that?
Well, thankfully, we have fossils. And actually, in this study, they had some really interesting fossils. They had what was essentially a bone bed of fossils from dinosaur embryos that had been scattered by various floods. Now, usually that's a bad thing. When you have scattering of all these bones, it's difficult to match up, you know, what bones belong to which individual. But here, actually, that turned out to be an advantage because the researchers knew that they were dealing with a lot of different embryos of the same species of dinosaur. And what was cool is because these floods kept on rushing into these nest beds, they were really killing these dinosaurs and these embryos at various stages of development. So the researchers were really able to see how fast these dinosaurs grew in their eggs. And what they noticed...
So bad for the dinosaurs, good for us.
Bad for the dinosaurs, good for us. And what they noticed was that looking at the sizes of the femur bones of the dinosaurs, also looking at what's called the vascular spaces, these are spaces where blood vessels and other tissues can grow into, what they were noticing was that these dinosaurs were growing incredibly fast, faster than any other known dinosaur on record, and faster actually than any other bird species or any other animal that scientists have studied.
So this is really making a link between embryo development and the final size of the organism.
Exactly. And what's really cool about this study is that the interesting results don't end there. The researchers, when they bombarded these bones with powerful X-rays, they actually found traces of what they suspect is organic matter inside the bones, which is really rare to find, especially in fossils this old. Now, there's been organic matter found in dinosaur fossils before. It's always been controversial. There's never been conclusive proof that these organic remains, sometimes which seem to be the remains of proteins, which may be the case here too, are not just contamination. But if it actually is true organic matter belonging to these dinosaurs, it would be the oldest organic matter on record and would really potentially shed some more light on what these dinosaurs were really made of.
Oh, well, how interesting. I can't wait to hear more about this.
Stay tuned.
So what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story on how new music rewards the brain, and also a very cool photograph of a ghostly green bubble in space. For Science Insider, our policy blog, the big story this week is President Obama's 2014 science budget, just which agencies are going to be the winners and losers of that, some of the big programs that are going to be cut, which programs are going to stay. We'll have continuing breaking news and analysis of that on the site. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about Jurassic Park. Speaking of dinosaurs, Jurassic Park, 20 years later. I know I told you guys last week that we were having that chat. We had some technical difficulties. We are rerunning it again this week, and we're hoping that it will be a video chat. We've got one of the world's most famous dinosaur experts, Jack Horner, on, who's been a consultant for all of the Jurassic Park movies, so be sure to check that out. Also, next week's Science Live will be on genetic privacy, just how much control control should we have over our own genetic information? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now, Science Policy from Science Insider, and Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.